Hey everybody, thank you again for tuning in to Boomchuck, a drummer's podcast. We are found everywhere podcasts are listenable. I really appreciate you tuning in. I have a very special guest this time. He's my buddy. We've gone back a few years now when our bands used to play together in Texas. Not only is he a drummer that's toured all over the U.S., he's also been crew member, front of house engineer, stage manager, and done production and pretty much everything you could think of in the music world. Here's my friend, Nathan Drake.
Hey, what's up, man?
Hey, buddy. So, yeah, man, what you been up to?
Right now, I am going back to school, finishing my degree.
Is that something that you... Is this a second degree? Or are you just finishing what you started a long time ago?
Well, technically both, because I have an associate's in music. But, yeah, I'm finishing what I started a long time ago, because when Courier started touring, I failed a couple classes and then just never went back to finish it. I didn't think I'd ever needed to or want to, but
right.
And I was too busy. Like it's like one of these classes where you if you miss like two classes, you fail. So like I was always touring and could never go back.
Right.
But because of COVID, it went online anyway, and I'm not touring now, so
right.
I figured I might as well knock it out.
Right on. We've known each other a while. We met obviously when you were we'd be coming down to Austin or whatever, and then you were in a band called Courier at that time, and we did tons of shows together. Courier kind of went down by the wayside, and you started basically just playing with other people, and then you got into the audio world, the production world, all this kind of stuff. So with all that, I was like, oh, you're like the perfect person to talk to, because being a drummer coming from that world, then you like literally you kind of have an insight. A lot of people ask me all the time, like, well, how do you get like this sound or whatever? Like, you know, you sound good. I don't sound that way. So like as a player, as a drummer, and then you as being a player, a drummer, and a sound guy, how does that mesh? So I was like, oh, I got tons of questions for you to answer. So hopefully
awesome.
I don't ask you something and you're like, I don't have any idea. I just say things. But anyway, so give me the quick rundown of how you got to be where you are. I mean, there's obviously you've been playing, you know, forever or whatever, but let me give you the brief history of how it all started.
Yeah. So started playing drums in high school. My brother actually bought a drum set. My little brother got a drum set and, came with a DVD, like how to play the basic rock beat.
Yeah.
And I watched it with him. It was like 10 minutes long. I was like, oh, I could do that. That's not that hard. Because previously I tried to learn how to play guitar because my dad played guitar, but that was just too hard. I hated it. So I was like, well, I'll just do sound instead. So I actually started doing sound before I started playing drums.
Okay.
But then I would just play on my brother's kit and eventually ask my youth pastor if I could be the middle school, like start the middle school band. And that's kind of where that started. Eventually moved to Austin, got connected with Courier pretty quickly. Became the drummer for them. I think we had our first show together like right after I joined the band.
Oh, was it really?
I think that was one of our like first little tours.
Oh, okay.
If I remember right. And anyway, we, you know, did the Courier. We were basically a band for about 5 or 6 years, 2 albums. Had a bunch of songs on TV, which was cool. A few really cool tours, like with Blue October and a band called Parachute. And eventually that dissolved. Played with Dalton Rapatoni, who was 3rd on American Idol in the last season when they canceled it for the first time.
Right.
then I switched to the crew side. I just wanted to get on the road, touring any way I could. Was stage manager for Missio for a while. And then switched to Texas Country, and I was stage manager for Josh Abbott Band for almost 3 years.
Oh, wow.
And that pretty much brings us to COVID. I left Josh when COVID started. I was kind of wanting to get off the road anyways. And so now I've been going back to school. Haven't been doing quite as much music stuff, but that's how I got here.
you were doing other things like kind of in that time for you jump from like year to year to year, but you did a lot of, you did a lot of stage work. Did you ever look back and just look at the drummer and be like, I'm better than you? Or like, just go like, oh my gosh, like I could be doing this so much better, or whatever. Did you ever have that itch still being stage and crew side of it? Did you ever have that itch to be like, okay, I need to do this again, or hopefully the drummer falls and breaks his arm, or, you know, gets in a bar fight and breaks his knuckle or something like that, so I can just take over?
Yeah, 100%. Not every time. I mean, sometimes, for me, it's like, you know, there were a couple tours I was on where the drummer was just a monster, and it was just like, well, I can't do anything better than he can, so like, I don't even care, you know? Because on one hand, it was actually the funniest thing switching from band to crew side was like, oh, it doesn't matter what I look like anymore. I can just wear whatever I want.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But so I enjoyed that side for sure, like being out of the spotlight completely. But there were definitely times where I was like, okay, I could be playing better than you. And for me, it's all about just making the show great. Like if there's a better drummer, then I'll be cool doing stage stuff. But if it's like, okay, I could be playing better than you, then I would rather be up there making the show better.
Right. So you never said anything out loud though, did you?
No. Well, you know, maybe a couple times. I mean, not like not being an asshole.
Right.
You know, I'll let people know if I think I can do a better job.
Like the drummer comes off stage and you're like, man, you really didn't play well tonight. I could have done it a lot better. I just talked to a guy that basically was just like, play anything and everything you can, because if you're not better than what you're going to be playing, do it like as much as you possibly can, because you never know. Like, and that's what makes you better. So it's like, it's the cool thing is it prepped you, I think, those years in the van and then doing all that, you know, doing touring with all that stuff. I feel like it probably prepped you for the crew side. You kind of knew what the band was going through and doing all this stuff. And I've heard a lot of people say like, oh, mostly crew guys are just guys that didn't make it. But I don't think the good crew guys are the guys that either just want to do that, want to be backstage, or like really good techs, like, or guys that have just done it and just don't want to do it. Or like you said, like want just a second out of the spotlight or whatever. I don't know. That's what I've come to find too. I don't know if you feel the same way, but
yeah, totally. I've toured with guys who just love being a crew guy. Like they live to be a crew guy.
Oh, yeah.
They love it. They be, you know, some of them came from a band, some of them didn't, and they just chose it. Also, sometimes it's you know, there's also a supply and demand factor. I mean,
right.
Like you can, like I, you know, at any given moment, I could go out and get a higher paying crew gig most likely than I can, you know, a drumming gig.
Right.
Because it's, you know, getting the drumming gig is more about being in the right place at the right time, which goes back to what you're saying about just playing everything and
right.
all. I mean, the guys that have like the really cool gigs, they still play the, you know, the Tuesday night bar gig just because somebody asked them to. And
right.
that's a part of networking.
Sure.
But yeah, there's a lot of crew guys that are definitely, you know, like right now hurting because they really, really just want to be on the road, you know?
Yeah.
They miss it, but it's not so much me. I mean, I really enjoy touring, but I'm not like, I don't live to be a crew guy. That's for sure.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I remember some of the crew guys that I've run into, they're like better musicians than all of us. Like there was a guy who, he's since passed away, but there was a guy who we went on tour with, and he was the tech for the headlining band, and he was like a library. You could just say a song and he'd go and pull it out and like play any guitar, and he was fixing things like my bandmate had his like his Fender Bassman head, and it was just giving him a little whatever, and he was like, oh, there's an hour before Doors. And he took the thing apart, took all, like, he did everything and, like, recalibrated everything, put it back together. And we're like, we'd already sound checked. We're like, okay. And he was like, it's better than normal. I re-soldered everything. And it was like, and he did it, like, no joke, in 45 minutes. We set it back up. He hit one chord. They opened the doors. And it was like, all right, we're about to go play a show. And, like, just things like
That's
that,
awesome.
Like, the technical mind and all that stuff. Like, but he was one of those guys that, he just wanted to be a crew guy. That's all he ever did and all he ever wanted to do. He literally passed away on the road being a crew person. So it was
wow.
like, yeah, yeah. it was there's definitely those people. I've always struggled with like the I could go out. I definitely did some TMing gigs and stuff, but I could go out and it's just like I'd rather be a drummer and not have to worry about any of that stuff than worry about that stuff and then think, oh man, I'm better than you. Like it's like, yeah, oh totally. Boy, yeah. I can't do that.
Yeah, it's a trade-off, man. I mean, there's some things that are a lot less stressful, and then there's some things that are more. You know, obviously, when things go haywire and you're getting yelled at, that's obviously super high stress. But you don't have to worry about, you know, nobody cares who you are. You can walk through the crowd and right. no one cares.
Right.
And you don't have to go do, you know, the band obligation type things like interviews and signings and all that stuff. So it's nice not to have to do that. It's right. a trade-off, you know.
No, for sure, for sure. The grass is always greener on every side, right?
Yep.
What do you think is the best? So looking at it from, obviously, we'll stick to the crew side of it. And like, because you're doing audio, live audio, you did ears for a long time too. Like, where do you think is the best, like, I guess the best way to perform? Looking at it as a drummer and having that in your soul, what do you like as a sound person? What do you think is the best, like, attribute to be able to give? You know what I mean? Like in a playing sense, like if a drummer comes up and he's unbalanced, obviously that makes your job a lot harder. What is like the best advice or the best thing that you like looking for as a drummer's playing?
You mean like your best attribute, like what makes them the good on stage or
I mean,
a good player?
Not even stage. I mean, like if you're at front of house or you're doing whatever, like, and a drummer comes up and he's just like all over the place or something, or like overplays, like what makes the sound guy work harder to make the performance go well? Like if there was a drummer that just went up and played balance or played, did whatever, had his technique down or whatever, like in drummer speak, cause I know you can do it.
Sure.
What do you look for? Like as a sound person, like what are your like, oh man, this guy's good. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to do this or this or this because he plays well.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, aside from obviously having good tone, we'll just assume that, you know, everybody
they
wants
do
good
their
tone.
Drums.
For me, it's about arrangement. Like that's how I think about drumming is, and I think that's probably my best skill as a drummer is the arrangement of the song. And that's the thing that's like when I'm at front of house, that's the thing that's most frustrating if a drummer is getting at wrong. It is so frustrating to mix a song if they're not hitting the transitions right or understanding where the song needs to go. That happens more so in, you know, if you're at a rock gig, it's well rehearsed. But like that happens a lot of church gigs where the drummer is just not in sync with the singer worship leader. And then like I'm trying to mix a song to go this way and then the drummer just doesn't do it. And that's like I will be like, it's good that I'm in the back because I will be like visibly frustrated. Like, are you kidding me?
Right.
That's the thing that I feel like, and it's not just drums either that really sets apart, you know, musicians is understanding the arrangement and direction of a song. Coming from country, there was, you know, our fiddle player that we were with, I was mostly at monitors but I did a couple front of house gigs, and it always amazed me, like I would never have to touch his fader, not ever, and he would come in and out and do solos and do all the stuff and I would never have to touch his fader, and that always amazed me that like he could just manage his own dynamic so well.
Right.
And that's what you should be able to do as a drummer to get arrangements right, is be able to come up and down properly and hit the transitions. And then that makes it so much more fun to mix. And really, I have to do so much less because you're taking the song where it needs to go.
Right. Right. Yeah. It makes your job as an audio person better. And that's important, I think, to learn, especially for people that listen to this and don't understand the musicality behind drums, or like you said, behind anything. That fiddle player could play with his dynamics. They have pedals and whatever to do that. But obviously, some stringed instruments or whatever, you can go out and play in a hall with nothing, and you have to control that. But it's the same thing. We're playing an acoustic instrument, right? Like, you have to know, hey, if you're bashing the snare right here, this is the bridge. And, you know, the guide told you in your ears, bring it down or whatever, and they're just not following it. Yeah. I think that makes total sense. And I think people, when they listen to this, are going to be like, oh yeah, like the music side of it really makes everyone else's job easier. if you're ebb and flowing with the song appropriately, which that's good. That's good advice.
Yeah, totally.
Do you feel it's the same way in the studio too? Like when you've done studio work and mixed stuff for other people, like, is it the kind of the same monster, I guess?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's definitely like if I'm mixing a song, a studio song, it's definitely easier if the band and the drummer has already got the arrangement correct. There's a lot more I can do. Like if I hear something, a place I want the song to go, like if I'm in Pro Tools, it's a lot easier to make that happen with or without the parts. Whereas live, you know, you're simply out of luck if the part's not there. But yeah, it still helps because if the drummer is taking the song to the proper place, they're probably thinking about cool ways to get it there. And then you have, you know, the cool fills and transitions that are really going to make the, you know, the choruses pop and that type of stuff.
All right. Shifting out of that, you posted a thing. You've redesigned a little room for yourself, but it's basically music, like your thing. Legos, Star Wars Legos, and beers that you've drank around the United States, right? Like, that's kind of you in a nutshell. Is that like your go-to? Like when you're at home or when you had a few weeks off between gigs or whatever, you just sipped on some beer and did Legos and that was about it? I mean, I'm the same way, so I love it. So that's why I wanted to bring it up, because it's just like, yeah, that's kind of your space, and your wife let you have that space. And honey, this is your room, and you can do whatever you want. But your man cave is drums, Legos, and beer. That's a good man cave in my mind. But
yeah, totally.
Is that like, why Star Wars? Why not like random? Just, are you a Star Wars nut that you just kind of like?
Yeah,
oh, Legos
I'm a
are
huge
cool?
I'm a huge Star Wars nut. I just like my grandfather got me started on the movies when I was a kid. And I just like, you know, I like read the books and the comics and like everything.
Oh yeah. Okay.
But,
nice.
My wife got me started on the Star Wars Legos. She bought me something like a Millennium Falcon for Christmas. And then I just kind of started collecting. What really, this is what's really dangerous, is that I realized that they actually gained value over time, which I feel like gives me more of an excuse to buy them.
Nice.
But
nice.
It, for me, I, you know, it's every few months I will buy something, and it's like just 2 or 3 hours of pure zen for me. Like I'll throw on a podcast or some music, and like nothing, like the world makes sense. I'm not stressed out. Nothing else matters except building Legos for 2 hours. And
yeah, man, it's an escape.
Yeah, totally.
I see it. I asked you earlier if there was anything you didn't want to talk about, but I'm going to ask you if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine too. October 1st, 2017, you were in Las Vegas. This is correct, right? This is a true statement,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
Do you mind sharing that story?
Yeah, so it was just a few months after I'd started with Josh Abbott Band. We opened this Route 91 festival in Las Vegas. It was like the end of like a week long run, so we were like super stoked to get home. We played at like 4:30 or something.
Okay.
And so we were already packed up, trailer loaded. We were just hanging out in the artist lounge, which was like side stage, and drinking and having a good time. We had like a red eye flight, like 12:30 a.m. flight, and like a
nice. Yeah.
Jason Aldean was on, and yeah, that's when the shooting started. I got lucky. I actually went to the bus, which was like opposite side from where the shooter was of the stage. Uh-huh. And I just went over there to grab something, and then randomly decided to try to take a nap, which I like never do because we had that flight. And that's when everything went down. So I was kind of hunkered down on the bus, but like where I was by right before that at the artist lounge was closest to the shooter, and that's where like the first hit. So I was really fortunate to not have been there and been in the bus, which is a lot safer.
Did you know anybody that got injured or even died when like in that?
No, I don't. We had at the time they had like a horn section and string section. So we had two buses, like 20 people, and everyone made it out. There were a couple guys that got hit by a shrapnel, you know, like kind of tripped and fell on their way out, but no. I mean, they all saw stuff. From what I understood, most of them and a lot of the crowd like ran under the stage, which was not bulletproof. So there was definitely some stuff that happened under there. And then, and I know a bunch of like Aldine's bus and a few of the bigger artists, they parked their buses right next to the stage, and they were like hunkered down in there. I know that one of, I think actually of all the bands and crew, I think only like one crew guy got shot, but he survived.
Yeah.
So no, I did not know anyone that, was injured from it.
It's, it is always crazy. Like, obviously we had known each other since, I mean, early, when was that? 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009 When were you in Courier? Like,
I joined Courier 2009. So it was probably fall 2009 or early 2010. Yeah.
So if we had known each other forever, and then it was, when things like that happen in the music industry, it doesn't matter what genre or what whatever that you're in, it affects everyone across the board, and you're always kind of like whatever. And then, you know, it sucks, and you're like, you know, you're watching the news, you're seeing what's going on, and you feel for those people. And then you posted straight up like, I was there, because people start, you know, I want to be careful because this is going online, but like there's the internet side where people are stupid, you know what I mean? And like they say dumb things, or they just don't understand. And a lot of people, like, our jobs and the career path that we've chosen is different than, you know, office workers and all this kind of stuff. So, but they don't see different sides of things. And, you know, this is before the political stuff has happened the last year. This is before COVID. This is before all this stuff. So the people just needed something to pick on, and I think you were pretty well spoken, and you took your time, and you're pretty, I guess, pointed in the direction you wanted to take of like, I was there, this is what happened, and this is how I feel about things like gun control and this all this stuff. And I thought it was awesome. I commend you for waiting and not just flying off the handle. I've quit Facebook. I'm still on it, but I've very much just like, I can't. Yeah. I'm at the point where I can't do comments. I can't do whatever. And it this actually started. I knew a crew member that we had when we toured with Sum 41 was in Paris and was one of the first people shot in the terrorist attacks in Paris. So it was like a very, just watching some people that I knew just like say stupid things like that you just don't understand. It's like, what is, like, use your brain. Yeah. Like, and there's time, it's a slip sometimes. They don't realize like, oh, whoops, my friend was there, or do whatever. And it's very much like it's common sense, man. We're all humans. When things like this happen, like, this isn't normal. This isn't normal anywhere. And it, you know what I mean? Like, so it's a very slippery slope when you start, you know, when you start reading comments and you start doing all this other stuff. But, you know, it's crazy to think that happened. And then I knew someone that was there. It was very much like this is nuts. Like, you know, even though the music community with all the genres and whatever across the board, I mean, it's small when you really think about it. It really is small, and a lot of people get affected, and, you know, it's funny to see, you know, the people that aren't, you know, that aren't in that world. Yeah. And when things happen, like, you know, when France happened and like all this other stuff, granted, I wasn't involved and I hadn't seen, you know, Nick in probably a year. And when it came out, like, like text thread of all of us, it was like, I couldn't get out of bed. It was like, this is like, man, I spent a year of my life with this person, got to know him, and he's gone. Yeah. And it was just, and it was a terrorist attack. It's like, it's crazy to think that that stuff happens where we are, but it, you know, again, it does, obviously, but yeah.
I know about I didn't know the guy you're talking about, but I know like one of the guys that I was with, Josh, he knew him. Mm-hmm. And then I remember when that happened, like Under Oath and a bunch of bands that I liked that also had toured with him, you know, tweeted about him. And yeah, it's definitely a small world.
That's why I asked, and I wanted to respect, like, maybe you don't want to talk about it. You want to put it behind you. Because, again, it's a traumatic experience, even though you are safe and your crew is safe and things happen. But, like, still, I mean, you found yourself in that situation, and it's just, like, mind-blowing. And, you know,
a lot of people don't think about – it's really easy these days, you know, after COVID, 500,000 people dead, and there's a shooting every other day. It seems like it's easy.
There was one yesterday, for crying out loud. Yesterday. Yeah.
It's easy to just – you just see these numbers. We're just like, you know, we get so much news on social media that we just see these numbers and we don't even think about the people. And like with Vegas specifically, like most mass shootings, even including all of the survivors, only involve like dozens or hundreds of people. Whereas in Vegas, there was 25,000 people at the festival, and it was on the Strip. So there, you know, I knew people that were, I didn't know at the time, but that were just there on a trip down the street, and they were still affected by it. So, you know, probably definitely tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people were affected in a traumatic way from that. And like, it was, you just don't think about it. Like, you know, we immediately got on a flight that night and then had a layover in DFW. And I remember like we were sitting at a bar just trying to, you know, get any kind of alcohol we could find. And this lady behind me just started watching the news video of it with the gun, like full volume, like right behind my head. I wanted to just turn around and slap her, but it's just like, it did not even occur to her that a survivor from there could already be, you know, there. And it's like, it's, you know, and you mentioned with Facebook, not a lot of people just don't, they literally cannot fathom that it's people. They don't think about that it's people. Right, it's just numbers. When you're talking about these policies and stuff, you don't think about like, oh, this could have happened to somebody I know.
Yeah.
And it could still happen to somebody I know. I definitely, it's interesting going through I'm still learning about it. It's only been, I guess, 3.5 years now, but, it's interesting. Like at first for me, the reaction was being super political, learning as much as I could about gun control, talking about it a lot. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was thought out. Sometimes I did, you know, fly off the rails a little bit.
I didn't see anything that I was like, oh boy.
Yeah.
It was you were very controlled, something I am not. So yeah, you did good.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I didn't feel that way all the time. I've learned it kind of sucks because like in order to get through and just like maintain some mental health, sometimes you have to just not care about that stuff. You know, I've learned there's times to open up and talk and discuss that type of stuff with somebody, and then there's times where you just have to ignore it because there's a lot of people that are just never going to change their mind, and they're also never going to care about it and what you went through. And like, unfortunately, it feels like the more it happens, the more conditioned we are to not care about it, instead of the more it happens, the more we should maybe change something about it.
Well, everybody's numb to it.
Yeah.
Like it's turning into a regular thing, and you're like, like it's not. And granted, when we were kids, obviously it's always been there. It's just more apparent now because of social media and phones and cameras. It's weird to say. I don't want to sound like a weirdo, like a conspiracy theorist, but like media lurks on it and they go crazy with it. But it's because like you can compile cell phone videos and make this timeline, and you can do all this stuff now, which you couldn't do back in the 80s and 90s. You know, you really couldn't do it either. But, you know, there's definitely that thing. So I'm glad you spoke out again. I'm glad you're here. You know, this it's good that I appreciate you talking about it, even, you know, for how brief that is. It's still it is a good story, and it's nice to have goodness come out of something so dark, you know, which is good.
Sure.
So on top of all of this, this podcast that I'm doing is about drums. So what I want to do now is just talk to you about your drums. What's your gear? What are you playing now? Is it the same kit you played back then? Cymbals? I want to go through everything. So what are your go-tos? What kit do you have now?
So I do still have the same kit. I only ever owned one kit, which is kind of crazy.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's the brand is called EpiArc, and back when the custom drums thing was just kind of getting hyped, I used to go in high school on the, I think it was just Pearl Drum Forum, and that's where everybody hung out. But it was just this guy who was like an architect or something who just made drums on the side. They were like $1,200, which is insane at the time. You know, it would cost twice that price. And I think when I graduated high school, I got some money and bought those drums, and that's all I ever used. Cause before that I was still playing my brother's kit.
Yeah.
Like I just used his drums for like 2 or 3 years.
That's awesome.
And Yeah, so then I bought, you know, like the most expensive, heaviest Pearl drum hardware, which I still have, and
Nice.
those Epiarc drums. And then I switched through a bunch of cymbals and snares. I've always used the same kind of cymbals, but have broken several because I used to play metal. So,
Nice, yeah.
but it's still just Meinl Byzance traditional cymbals.
God, you were rocking those back like when it wasn't even cool to rock those, which is good. I mean, that's cool. You were ahead of the curve.
Yeah, I still love them. It sucks because every time you get a new one, it doesn't sound the same. And
Sure,
there are
yeah.
certain ones that are gems and certain ones that are just not. But you know, you get used to them and whatever. But
Right.
it for my drums, the kit is it's just you know maple shells, and then it's 22 by 16 kick. It's shallower, which I dug, and then 12 by 8 tom, 16 by 14 tom, just real basic four piece. That's always been my style. And then for the cymbals, it's eventually I switched to 15 inch hats, which I still have, and then 20 21 crash, 22 ride.
So
But
big symbols all the time.
yeah, now
Yeah.
I cymbals are so much more expensive now that I feel like the price of bronze has gone up like 50%, but
I think it's not the price of bronze. I think it's the price of that name.
yeah, probably
But
so.
yes.
Probably so.
Yeah.
But the last few times I was in the studio that I had used like either 16s or 18s that somebody had made with crashes, and I was like, this sounds so much better. So I would totally go with like bigger hats if I ever bought some.
I used to have a set of 16s, and I liked them. I kind of wish I didn't. Obviously, they weren't Bosphorus, which I'm playing now, but I liked them. They were really low pitched.
Yeah.
I never actually recorded any like major studio stuff with them, but like they were really low.
Yeah.
But it was more, I'm interested to see 18s. I don't know. I've had friends that have done that, like with two crashes or whatever.
Sure.
Having the control on your hi-hat is very much like,
Totally.
when you get bigger and bigger and bigger, it's harder and harder and harder
That's
to
why,
maintain that.
I've stuck with the 15s because it's a nice balance
Yeah.
between the articulation and the big sound. For certain songs in the studio, it's fun to even use like 13s just to get really nice articulation. Because I do
Right.
like that articulation and the tightness. But it does like, you know, speaking, especially like approaching it now as a mixer, like having the bigger, lower pitched hats are easier to fit in the mix that aren't as sharp.
Yes. Yes.
And that's why I've always used the Meinl because they're just so musical. Like one of my last church gigs I had, sound guy hated cymbals with a passion, and
Yeah.
he started making me use these like the church had these just real small like Zildjian A's or something like that, just something which to my ear just sounds incredibly harsh and
Shrill.
awful and
Yeah.
shrill and unmusical, and I complained about it constantly, obviously. But I feel like bigger, darker, trashier is more musical to my ears in the way that I play. So
No,
let's use
I'm the same way. Yeah. I
that.
say my joke is I like my cymbals like I like my women. Bigger, darker, and trashier.
Yes.
But yeah, so yeah, it's a very much I'm that same way, and I think recording wise, people for those of us that have the recording ear and like do studio stuff on it, it's way more it is more balanced, like you said. I like that how you said it sits in the mix. Now, granted, you can't bash the crap out of them either. Like once you start doing that to a 20 and a 21 inch crash, it doesn't matter what symbol it is, it gets out of hand. But yeah, so you got to play with good technique as well. But yeah.
Because they to get that darker, trashier sound, you go thinner, and so it's
And
just more fragile.
it's terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah, I you know it took a long time, but I feel like I've learned at a certain point you learn like, oh, hitting it harder actually doesn't gain me anything, and then
Yeah.
hitting it straight on definitely doesn't gain me anything. Eventually you learn like, oh, I can hit this softer and swipe it and save the cymbal for longer and still gain what I need to, you know?
Yeah, I haven't broken a cymbal in a really long time, and I play hard.
Yeah.
And you've had those drums for so long. What, like, I guess now, because heads, for me, heads have always changed. Really, it's always been what can I get cheaper?
Oh yeah,
But
totally.
still have some life, you know, obviously. Because you've had those so long, you kind of know what sounds good on those. What heads are you using on that kit?
Well, I've always used Evans Evans G2s. I've just switched between coated and clear.
Okay. Same on the bottom? G2s on the bottom too?
No, or just... I do G1s on the bottom. Or the just generic resonant, either one. Whatever one I can get. I'm the type of guy that I'll just pick something and then just stick with it. So with Evan, you know, I just picked Evans G2s and just stuck with it. I've played kits with Remo and other stuff that I've liked, but I've never been able to, like, put a Remo head on a drum myself and make it sound the way I like. Just Evans just has that tone. And it's probably just because I know it better. But I mean, the way that I tune my drums, and since I know my kit, is I use that two ply head. I put it on, I tune it as low as it can possibly go and still have tension. You know, I just know that sweet spot, and because I hit hard, and I'm generally, you know, even if I'm not playing rock, I'm playing a rock style. So I want that. I want the lowest that every drum can still sing, essentially. And so with the two ply, that gets me where I need to go. On snares, I definitely prefer one ply G1s, but
really,
I prefer it, but I don't use them because I will go through it in a couple weeks. But I prefer the way they sound. So I've the G2s are fine on a snare, but I feel like I can almost hear it. It's like too dead. I feel like it can almost hear when the plies separate. And then it's just like, I just don't like that. So Evans, a few years ago, they came out with a G14. So it's just like a 7 mil one ply. And that's kind of the sweet spot for me. I've never liked the power dot stuff. I feel like that just kills it in the wrong way. Even though I'm putting loads of tape on it, I want to do that myself. I want to do it my way.
I was going to say, I've seen videos of you playing with like big fat snare drums and tape and all this stuff. And I'm like,
I will say, pretty much always use big fat snare drums now.
They're the greatest things ever. I love them. Yeah.
And actually, I didn't even buy one until a few years ago. For the longest time, I just cut old heads and used those.
The Darren King method. Yeah, yeah. We know. I've talked about that several times. Yeah.
So that's generally what I use. I just switch between coated and clear. I will say overall, I prefer coated. Right now, I have clears on. And they're nice for some. It's such a stylistic choice, depending on, especially in the studio. But I prefer coated. It's just warmer to me, and my drums like it too. So
I'm the same with every kit I've ever had. Coateds, and that's the thing. I played oak for so long with my Yamaha oak.
Mm-hmm.
It always just sang. It was obviously a firmer wood, so the resonance was like it had a huge attack to it. So I wanted the deadness of a coated head. So I've always been that way. My ears always go that way.
Yeah, it's tough to sell it. Like, you have to feel good at your kit to be able to perform well. You know, confident. If clear heads don't feel good, it doesn't even matter if they sound good. You know, it's like
who cares? Who cares what it
feels good? Otherwise, you're not going to sound good.
Exactly.
The one unique thing I do with my heads, though, is I have the what is it? Is it Aquarian kick?
Yeah.
It was a Super Kick 1. I have that
Super
on my kick.
Yeah.
And I've never changed it, not even once.
The head?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Between studio and all that stuff, you never changed your head?
No. I want.
How many years have you had that on there?
I mean, since I bought it, like 10 years.
Shut up. What?
So what I do is I just change the kick pad whenever it wears down so the head won't break.
And it's not dented in any way. It still holds, you know,
some
tone.
Obviously it's super dead, but that's what I like that.
That's great. Do you have anything in your bass drum? Like
a
pillow or
there's a pillow in there. And I've changed the back head, you know, based on whatever band I'm touring with usually.
Right.
But I just dig it.
That's insane.
Yeah, well, it kind of goes with the shallower, since it's only 16D.
Sure.
Because if it was an 18, like, you know, most people use those Evans heads with the ring around them, and that gets that big rock sound. But since it's the shallower one, I just like it being punchy. And once it's mic'd up, it sounds great. I've just always dug it. And it came from my brother's kit that he bought that I learned on. Was like, he got it for like $100. It was like a Japanese mahogany kit. Sunlight, I think, was the brand.
Oh, yeah.
And it had that kick head on it that was super old, and it just sounded amazing. That one was a 22 by 14. And it was one of those kicks where, like, I could set it up at a gig and like start tuning it, and like drummers would look over and be like, dude, that sounds awesome. And so I was just like, well, I'm always going to use that head.
That's crazy.
And I never got it.
Is that kit still around? Is that Sunlight kit still around?
It actually is. It actually, that, it's, I think that our old youth group is still using it. My brother,
he gave
it to them.
That's awesome.
But I will say that I've never liked my kick as much as that old mahogany one.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. That one was a 22 by 14. And I don't know if I'd go that deep, but if I could, and I'm sure I could get somebody to make one for me, because it's just a black satin stain. But like, if I could have a mahogany kick and then the maple toms, like that would be money for me.
Have you thought about that? Like, is that guy still making drums?
No, but it's just those, it's whatever maple shells every custom company uses.
Right. So, Keller or whatever.
Keller. I just feel like, with that old kick head, it's just seated perfectly, you know, like it's totally dead, but it's seated perfectly. And I just love that. So I've just always,
that's so interesting. Yeah. How about sticks? What sticks do you play?
Right now I switched to the Ahead aluminum sticks a few years ago.
Really?
Yeah. For the longest time I used, I was endorsing Silver Fox for a while, but they switched manufacturers and it was like, I could pick up a pair that was amazing and weighted perfectly, and then I could pick up a pair and it would break immediately and feel horrible. And I tried some Vic First for a while, but I realized I had to go to Guitar Center, play every pair and only pick the ones that were weighted properly. And I hated that variance in wood. And then one, like, it's, you never hear this story going well, but my mother-in-law was in Hawaii at Mick Fleetwood's restaurant with the $50,000 DW gold kit, and he sells his Ahead sticks there. And so she bought them for me for Christmas, and I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then I tried them, and I was like, oh, these are actually really cool. And it was just a regular 5A size, but then they have a 5B rock weighted set that is like forward weighted, which is what I like. And I just started using them. And I love them because I had a lot of problems with tennis elbow. And so with the aluminum, it greatly reduces the shock to your arm. And I felt like I had to do so much less work, and it was just so much more pleasant to play. And then I just knew that they were going to feel the same every time I pick them up. And you're supposed to be able to keep the same sticks and just change out the sleeves, which are like $4.
Right.
But I would always end up breaking them because what would happen is I would accidentally rim shot my floor tom, and they would just snap them right in half.
Yeah.
So
you do feel awesome though when that happens.
You're totally,
like,
yeah.
Ah, and you flex. Yeah.
But I would still, like, I could use a pair when I was gigging frequently. I could use a pair would last me like 3 months, and they're like $30. But you know, if I'm only buying 4 or 5 sets a year, it just made a huge difference. It's to the point where, like, if I pick up wood sticks, it feels so uncomfortable on my arms. Like, I feel like I can feel it in my bones.
Yeah.
And so I started getting, after I had those injuries, I was like super conscious about the wear and tear on my arms, and I just liked it. And I don't feel like they sound any worse. There is a little bit of a difference on the cymbals, but they have options for tips, like how soft or hard they are. So like softer ones sound a little bit more like wood, but they don't sound any different on the drums.
They don't have options for the sleeves, right? It's just the plastic.
Like, yeah, so there's two different tapers. So like, because I like the forward weighted ones, that was less of a taper, and then I actually still have those Mick Fleetwood ones that I'll use on quieter gigs that are a longer taper, so they're like rear weighted, more like kind of jazzy style.
Yeah.
And I will say I got to see Fleetwood Mac a few years ago, and that dude still plays as hard as I do at 70 whatever years old.
I mean, when that's all you're doing, like, and just going for it, like, he doesn't have the arthritis pains on the tennis elbow. He doesn't have that, but maybe that's because of those sticks.
I'm sure it helps him play the way he still does with, you know, I'm sure that's not all he's doing, and I'm sure he does have some pain, but I, it just amazed me because for 3 hours he sat there and just played, you know, rock and roll drums with those sticks. And I was like,
that's cool.
So anyway, I highly recommend anybody just to try those. If you ever see some or get to try some, it's, they're better than you would think.
I remember back in the day, I played the Lars Ulrich ones, which is, I mean, they're just huge.
Yeah.
Which but it took me, you have to commit because I know the feeling that you're talking about. It almost take, it almost like, I can't, it's hard to describe, right? Like it's just like dead. You're hitting things and there is no reverberation.
Yeah.
It's really strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I never liked it. Yeah. I never liked it. It was always just like this, I feel like it's just not doing something. But again, it is very technique forward. And like when I got a lot into education and stuff, it is like very much like you've got to hold your stick properly, number one.
Yeah.
You've got to, you know, there's other things you can do. There's releasing your fingers. And I noticed, man, when I don't play, if I take 2 or 3 days off, yeah, my fingers hurt. Like my fingers hurt, my hands swell. Like there's different things. Or when, or on the opposite, when we go play, when we start going to play and we ramp up practice, we go the first 3 or 4 shows of a tour. I'm that age where, yeah, I want the ice bucket in the hotel. Like, okay, you know, take the swelling away. But eventually that goes away. I know exactly that feel. And if that's the thing is, if you're used to it like you are, I could totally see it being hard to come back to a wood stick and whatever. If you're saying that it reverberation going away is helping, you know, the injuries that you had, that's great.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's working. Like I'm going to keep that in the back of my mind for when my elbows start going.
Yeah, totally. Sure. And I will say, you know, the elbow thing was mostly a technique thing that I worked on that too, but I just felt like, I felt like it was a worthwhile trade-off, and I don't like buying sticks all the time. And I, you know, it's probably mostly the consistent feel that I like the most. Like I like
that
knowing
makes sense, yeah.
Every time I pick it up, whatever pair it is, they're going to feel exactly the same. I still tape them because it's like a rough aluminum handle. And so I would still use gaff tape on them. For when I was really hurting, I used 2-inch gaff tape and it would make like a bundle around it. So I would less. But I like it better with, you can buy a little like a 1/2-inch gaff tape on Amazon and I would just wrap that real thin. And I love the way that feels. I love the way the gaff feels.
Sticky.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want that sticky. Then the sticks don't fly out of your hands.
Yeah, they don't. So I think they're better for cymbals too because of that plastic sleeve that's on them.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, you're hitting it with a softer material.
Yeah, unless you wear through the plastic and then you're hitting it with metal and then you're screwed. Yeah.
But then I say, you know what, honestly, when you're touring and you have, you know, your pair of sticks and then maybe 2 backup pairs of sticks, your stick bag is real light, you know, and you don't have to, that's kind of nice.
It is.
How about ears? Do you wear in-ears, like full in-ears when you're playing, or do you do headphones or what's your preference?
I've used ears since high school pretty much. Mm-hmm. For the longest time, I didn't have molds for a long time until maybe 2015, 2014, somewhere around there. And I got Future Sonics. And they're unique because they don't use the balanced armature drivers that most ears use, which are like the, you know, 18 or 37 drivers in your ears or whatever. It's just one single cone, which is kind of unique. And I like them fine. I honestly don't think it matters what ears you get because they're all, you know, most of them are about the same and you're probably never going to hear another pair ever. So just pick some and get used to them. But yeah, I would use ears. I've probably gone through a dozen cables, but I've used the same ears playing and crew for a long time.
This isn't a stretch, but because of your audio, the audio side of things, the crew side of things, I wanted to ask, what are your preferred mics exclusively for drumming? Like when you when you're going to mic up a kit or do whatever, even if you're front of house and you're mixing it, what are the mics that you go to on a drum kit? This is not a tar. It's not a hard question. Come on.
No. Yeah. Well, I was just thinking because a lot of the basic live mics to me are not that different. Like a lot of the kick mics are, you can just pick whatever one you want. A lot of people stand by the Telefunkins now, which I do like the M80 on the snare a lot. But actually my go-to, I have a Beta 52 that I use on kick most of the time, but I also really like the Audix the D2 or D6 or whatever the kick one is.
The six, yeah.
Yeah.
It's bassy, yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I like that one on floor tom a lot too.
Yeah.
But weirdly, actually, like I do this in my studio. I have a Beta 52 on the kick, and then I have the Sennheiser 602s on my toms.
Okay, yeah.
So I really like using kick mics on my toms, like floor tom and even the high tom, because I mean, you know, most crew guys like to use those little tiny 604s that just clip on because they don't want to work. But I prefer to have the same mic on both my toms, even having the kick mic on the high tom.
Why is that? Just for audio reasons, like why do you like the same mic on the different basic tonal instruments?
Well, I like so the reason I like the 602 on or any kick mic on floor tom is because it has the perfect scoop. I think it has a scoop right around 500. You're going to do it anyway, but it already has it there and it boosts the low end. Because the high tom is actually lower pitch than most people think, and it's not that far off from the low tom. And I would rather just have the consistent sound, especially for me as a four-piece drummer with two toms. I want those toms to be pretty close together. Not mm-hmm. pitch-wise, but sound-wise. Like, I want it to feel...
Yeah.
And then it just makes it, if I'm at front of house, you know, chances are I'm not on my own console and I'm going to have to mix this band faster than I want to. And having the same mic just gets me closer where I want to more quickly. And it really just preference. I just like it. I like that scoop that the kick mics have and just makes it easier. I feel like the 604s are like too papery for me. It's just like the 604 sounds so much different from the 602. That I'm going to have to spend more time on the 604 to get it to sound close enough.
Right.
Whereas you could just put two 602s on there and then it's so much easier.
Yeah. How about overheads?
Overheads, I don't really care. I mean, if you're on a big enough tour where you're playing like House of Blues, where they have a decent stage that's actually treated.
Yeah.
Then it's cool to get large diaphragm condensers if you're using your own console and you can get those dialed in. When we toured with Parachute, their guy used, I can't remember what they were. I think they were Shure's. And he barely used the tom mics. Like, he actually got most of the toms from the overheads.
Oh, wow.
And you have to have a certain kind of drummer to do that. Like, they were very, like, he would play very tight, closed hat choruses, not an exorbitant amount of cymbals, so you could actually use the overheads in a mix.
Right.
For most drumming, like if it was me playing, I would probably, like a lot of times, like I just mic the hat and the ride with small diaphragm condensers. I don't care which ones. I have some SE Electronics in my studio. But yeah, I really don't care which ones. You can use Behringer's for all I care. But I just mic pointed at the bell of the ride and then come in from the side on the hi-hats. And I feel like that gets a little bit of an interesting sound off the drums. And then it's just cymbal mics. So that I can, and that's for me as a mixer, I can bring in the hi-hat and the ride as I need it for dynamics.
Yeah.
And then crashes are going to be there no matter what.
Yeah. There's nothing you can do, especially when you play 20 and 21 inch crashes, right?
Yeah. But in a studio, I think about it a little bit differently. If you can afford two large diaphragm condensers, that's cool. But I just use small diaphragm, and I've always done, like, I put a line between the middle of the snare and the middle of the kick, and then I put the overhead spaced evenly on either side of that. So it actually ends up being like, there's one mic over my left crash above my hi-hat and then one mic kind of over my floor tom. And so then I can pan those. I always mix overheads full left and right, and that just gives me a stereo image, a wider stereo image. I always feel like having the mono overhead in the studio. So I have like one nice Mojave large diaphragm condenser, and I'll put that kind of just like right over the middle of the kit. And that mono overhead in the mix just makes a huge difference in feel in the studio.
Do you have it on the same plane as your other two overheads, or do you have it way high?
Or is it
close?
Sometimes closer. Like, I'll play around with it. Sometimes I'll always almost make it like a half room, half overhead, and kind of have it pointed at a 45-degree angle, like maybe, you know, 10 feet from my head, kind of like out in front of the kick.
Right.
And that just gives like a, you know, I wish I could, you know, if you ever do it and then just mute it and unmute it, and it's just a world of difference to me. And just feel, and it, which is weird because you don't think about like a mono mic adding vibe like that, but it really does. Right. Especially because I'm mixing my drums so wide overhead and toms, I pan completely out right and left. So I think having that to bring it a little bit more center helps a lot.
Any other gear that you use that you're just like, that's your go-to thing, you're never going to get rid of it? Like, I mean, it could be anything now. Like, there's so many little pieces of gear in the music world. What, like, anything that you go to and use and you'll never get rid of?
Yeah, there's actually one mic. I'm going to have to look up the name of it. It's an Electro Voice RE50. So it's an omnidirectional dynamic microphone.
Okay.
I got it for like $50 on Craigslist. You'll see it in like old broadcast mic situations.
Yeah.
It's like brown and ugly, and like the Pope uses it and stuff like that. I really like that as my bottom snare mic, especially like I've recorded some live records like at church, and I'll use it as a bottom snare mic, but like get it as close to the kick as I can. Mm-hmm. And then it's kind of like a hybrid front kick, bottom snare mic. It's like super vibey because bottom snare usually sounds super shitty to me.
Yeah, it's the
and
worst.
So this like, and just having an omni dynamic mic is like so cool to me.
Yeah.
And so I use that. I still use, you know, I use it in my studio, and I'll use it whenever I record anywhere else. And I love the way it sounds. It's that's just like, cool. It's just something that's unique. It's like right. In this world of microphones that all sound 1% different from each other. Right. This is something that's actually like way different and cool. So
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing I'll never get rid of. And then the other thing would probably be the like in the studio I use the UA Apollo interface, and I love their plugins, and especially for recording on drums, like having that the way that their console software works, it makes recording a lot easier and latency easier, and I will never not use their interfaces. Just because of that.
Well, yeah, man. I mean, that's all I got. So I appreciate you. I mean, talking, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, I feel like we kind of hit it all going through. I do want to point out your Instagram handle is at Nathan Drake Music. There's another Nathan Drake out there. Did you know that?
Yeah.
It's like Nathan_Drake. And I was like, who is this imposter?
Anyway. Yeah. I don't know if I've seen that one on Instagram, but I was an idiot. And when Gmail came out, I decided to get like, some dumb, my AOL instant message name. And so I can't get any version of Nathan Drake on Gmail, like any version at all.
Really? That's funny.
Yeah. So anyway, there's a few. And there's also a very famous video game character from Uncharted.
Yes. Yeah. So. When I was doing my little bit of research, that I was like, oh boy, I had to like figure out what keywords to put in. I do want to leave you with one last story. And I don't know if you've ever heard this story. So we recorded, obviously, that I Am Dynamite's first album we recorded at Pedder and Alice, which was Willie Nelson's studio. We broke that tape machine. I don't know if you knew that, but
no,
we broke it.
So awesome.
It's the studio's closed now, so I can say it out loud. But we didn't break it. The engineer broke it, but it was, we were recording on it. Anyway, two or three weeks, you guys all came out and you were on our album, like playing percussion and yelling and screaming. Remember that? So I think you guys went out, Courier ended up going out there a month after that and doing your record, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe we used at least the same engineer. I think you guys had another, obviously Matt was there. I think you had another producer too, or whatever. It doesn't matter. But I heard from someone that we both know and a few other people that, did you one take some of that stuff? Do you even remember?
A couple of them, yeah.
So I was told, again, this is a month after our debut album, this big thing, whatever. I was told they were like, I've never recorded, the engineer, I've never recorded a drummer that's had such good groove and was dead on and blah, blah, blah. I'm looking at him like, hello, I'm right here. I was so mad, like not mad at you, but I was just like, really? Like a month goes by and you guys forget that I like poured my soul out into that stupid tape. I did everything to tape and it was dead on. I don't know. It was like, screw you guys. So anyway, you were like back in the day that was like that whole thing went down and like everyone was just like, oh, you're so good. You're so, and they just left me, like just put me out in the pasture, like go ahead, whatever. So anyway, I don't know if you ever heard that or whatever, but that literally happened. Like, I mean, I don't even think you guys had like had a mix yet. It was just like, oh my gosh, he killed. He played so good. And I was like, come on. I did my best. Anyway.
Well, thank you. You know, what's funny about that is, one, the reason that at the time, like, I was all about playing every single song exactly the same way.
Yeah.
So I would just, you know, I knew exactly what I was going to play, and engineers love that.
Yeah.
But he had just gotten off a gig with Mike Portnoy.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure it was a very famous band that you guys toured with, maybe. I won't say the name. I don't remember.
You can say the name. It's fine. It's just Blocktober stuff?
No, I wanted to say Sum 41, but it's not.
Oh, some, yeah.
Because that was, anyway, it was another big rock band in that vein. I can't remember. But he recorded with them for 6 months, and he said he was horrible.
Really?
Yeah, he would come in and like do like 20 takes of a song, and then hire a tattoo artist to come in and then do another 20 takes. And he said he ended up like comping through hundreds of takes of drums. And so that's why he
went from Portnoy, that. I'm sure Portnoy played at things different every time. And it was like this crazy. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so freaking crazy.
That's probably why he enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So
and you just laid down a groove dead on the click and you were just like the same every time. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. I'm sure that's exactly what it was. And also I totally forgot. I was looking at my hand. The first show we played, you were talking about your heavy Pearl hardware that you still own to this day. I have a scar on my hand. I mean, you can see it, but like, I don't know if you can see it right there. It's literally from your pulling out that heavy hardware in your SKB case. I still have a scar on my hand. And I remember playing that. There's pictures of me wearing silly sunglasses, playing, you know, on that stage. And there's just blood pouring out of my hand.
Oh,
like,
my
it's just
gosh.
Like, and it's every time I see it, I'm like, stupid Pearl hardware. So you mentioned that.
I don't remember
like,
that at all. That's amazing.
But again, I didn't say anything. It was just like, oh man, I got scratched. And then no joke, like as I'm going through whatever, how many shows, we were in Texas so much for so long sometimes. Like we played Stubbs and I think we went to Houston or Dallas or whatever and then came back to North Carolina and that scar still there, man. So you're with me forever.
That's amazing.
That memory of that stupid heavy hardware. Get some
thanks
lighter
for
hardware.
Yeah, no kidding. Thanks for contributing to my 200-pound hardware case journey.
Dude. I mean, hey, seriously, you get some Yamaha Crosstown hardware. Just get it. It's game changing. Like, if you're gonna go back on the road and you're gonna go play, get that because your 200-pound hardware case it ends up being, I don't know, 40 pounds.
That's
my
amazing.
Case, my road case weighs more than all my hardware.
Yeah, now my drum room is upstairs, and so like now people ask me to gig, and I'm like, no way. You know, unless it's like for most things, I will just say no because I'm like, I don't want to drag that downstairs. But I need to get another kit, and I want to
send them my way. If you say no, I'll be like, no, call Chris, he'll go.
Yeah, call Chris. He's in North Carolina. He'll
yeah,
go.
Yeah, fly him out. It'd be good.
I want to get a kit and bags. And get something like that hardware that's just in a bag that I can keep in my garage, throw in my car, not break my back. It's like I every single time I set up drums now, I'm like, I could have just played bass, dude.
I know. I mean,
I have so many more gigs too.
Yeah, you'd think that, but you wouldn't be the cool guy in the band. You know what I mean?
No, definitely not.
You wouldn't be the cool guy. People come to see the drummer. That's for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, well. All right, buddy. Well, man, it was a pleasure talking to you. It's good to see you.
Yeah, man. Great to catch up. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Well, yeah, man. I appreciate it. I wanted to get the audio side of it, so I'm hoping that came through. Obviously, like, the questions I asked you, you know, were geared towards that, but it was very much like the drummers, the people want to know, like, what can they do to make it easier for everybody else because, you know, then it makes it easier on them. So
yeah, totally.
All right, buddy. Well, yeah, man. Again, good to see you. That's awesome.
Good to see you, too.
Thank you again for tuning into this episode of Boom Chuck, a Drummer's Podcast. I really think there was a lot of information in here that Nathan and I talked about. Hopefully some of it great when it came to the audio things and tips and tricks and things that you might use as you grow in your playing. You can look up and follow Nathan on Instagram at Nathan Drake Music. Shout out to Mizio, Dalton Rapini, Josh Abbott Band, and all of the bands that he's worked with throughout these few years. Do want to say one thing about the Vegas shooting and the Vegas survivors out there. We're standing strong, Vegas strong. I know it's been a few years, but we still have you in our thoughts and our prayers. This is Chris Phillips. Thank you so much for listening to Boom Chuck, a Drummer's Podcast. I'm going to leave you with a song from the band Courier, Nathan's former band. Here is Paper Ghost.